On this episode of China Unscripted, the joys of studying Xi Jinping thought, what it's like being followed by a mysterious woman in Hong Kong, and Hong Kong police have lost their minds. Hi, welcome to China Unscripted. I'm Chris Chappell.
I'm Shelley Zhang.
And I'm Matt Ganesta.
And before we get into it, I just want to introduce the tea that we are drinking tonight. Shelley, you just made a very strange face.
I was just laughing about how Matt's "I'm Matt Ganesta" was super low this time.
I try to deepen my voice so I sound more authoritative.
Okay.
Ah. So anyway,
I just want to be more like Chris Chappell.
Hey, we can't all have Chris's golden pipes.
Hey, speaking of golden, tonight we are drinking tea from our sponsors, Path of Cha. The tea tonight is award-winning Yunnan Dianhong Black Tea. And the leaves are golden tipped. Now, so have a sip, guys. Enjoy.
Stop sipping into the microphone, guys.
They need to know that we're doing this for real. It's like 9 at night and we're drinking tea.
This offends Chris's sensibilities.
It does.
But the tea is quite nice.
Yeah. So this actually won a silver medal at the 2018 Spring Global Tea Championship. So this is award-winning tea.
It's a beautiful color, too.
Yeah, so this is what in China they would call a red tea, but what we would typically in the West call a black tea.
I've never heard of red tea.
Well, red tea is what we call black tea. But yeah, so the leaves themselves are beautiful. They've got like this twisted kind of golden leaf quality to it. Yeah, so again, thank you to our sponsors, Path of Cha. I highly recommend getting some of your own. We're drinking again tonight the award-winning Yunnan Dianhong Black Tea. We have a link below, so order through that and support the show. In case you're listening on iTunes where you don't have a description, the link is www.pathofcha.com/?ref=China Unscripted.
Thank you for your support.
Thank you. Enjoy the tea. Joining us today is Kevin Carrico. Kevin, you've done a lot of really important things. You've authored several amazing books about China. You lecture on China studies at Monash University. You were recently on the front lines of protests in Hong Kong. But in my humble opinion, your greatest achievement? Becoming a certified expert in Xi Jinping thought on socialism with Chinese characteristics for a new era. Please, tell us about how you got that certificate.
Oh, well, yeah. I signed up for this online edX class offered in cooperation with Tsinghua University on, you know, I can't remember perhaps the full title. It was quite long, but yeah, something with Xi Jinping thought on socialism with Chinese characteristics for the new era, et cetera, et cetera. And I signed up really just as a joke. But as I went through the class, I realized that I was paying enough attention that I was really, you know, acing all of the multiple choice quizzes that were being offered.
What were some of the questions?
Oh, some of the questions? Well, the questions were vacuous enough for me to have completely forgotten. Generally, there were questions like, how many times did Xi Jinping say the word or the term "the people" in his speech to the 17th Party Congress, or so, you know, something along those lines? And wow, this was, you know, taken to be evidence of his deep care and concern for the people, right?
Oh, naturally.
So as I proceeded through, I realized I was doing so well that I might as well invest $49 in getting an official certificate.
Ooh, that's Chinese communism in action.
Yeah. And so I, you know, eventually I passed with flying colors and I got my certificate. I have it hanging on the door of my office. After I wrote an article about the class that was, one might say, you know, mildly critical, the class was actually canceled very quickly. And also, as a result, my certificate was erased.
Oh, no.
Thankfully, I saved it as a PDF so I can have that as a testament to my achievements in the field.
And also all the lessons you learned have been saved in your heart.
Yeah. But I really regret ruining the fun for everybody when I wrote a little article on foreign policy mocking the entire class.
Well, what you've essentially done is guaranteed that you are one of the few experts in this class.
Yes, indeed. And, you know, Xinhua should start contacting me for commentaries on Xi Jinping thought.
I was going to ask if anybody had been in touch since you, a foreigner, had aced this class.
It's funny, when I was in Hong Kong in 2017, on the 20th anniversary of the handover, somebody from Xinhua based in Australia actually emailed me and sent me a number of questions, you know, sort of along the lines of, how has the Chinese Communist Party helped Hong Kong become a wonderful place since 1997? And, you know, how much do you think, the CCP has helped Hong Kong, a million percent or 2 million percent or something, you know? And I just told them, I said, I can't answer these questions dishonestly, and if I answer them honestly, you're not going to publish them. And they never got back in touch with me, unfortunately. So,
but speaking of getting in contact with people connected with the Chinese government, you actually had been under surveillance in Hong Kong.
Yeah, that was a another very interesting moment in late 2018. I have to say 2018 was quite the year. You know, I get my certificate in Xi Jinping thought. Chinese state media follows me in Hong Kong. It's quite the year. Yeah. So, I visited in December of 2018 for about 10 days. I did one talk with a sort of an NGO interested in political developments. And most of the other time I was just researching, meeting with friends, etc. Was basically the second day I was there, I was riding on the MTR, and I noticed a lady looking at me at times, and she had a sweatshirt that said Oxford University. And, I was sort of perplexed. I don't know. I mean, you guys have seen me. Women don't look at me a lot, you know?
do I know her kind of thing?
Wait. Yeah. I mean, you know, I'm not, people aren't exactly trying to glance at me a lot, you know? So I was trying to think, I thought, do I know her? And then she had an Oxford shirt on, and so I thought, maybe she read my book and she recognized me. I don't know. But that seems very, very far-fetched. I got off the train, walked around a shopping mall, as we do in Hong Kong.
So true.
And then as I walked, I noticed everywhere I went, this lady was there, and I started to realize, like, wow, this is really either a really odd coincidence or this lady's following me. So I went down to the bathroom in the basement of this mall, and when I came out of the bathroom, this lady, she was right there, in the basement, and that's when I realized, okay, this is extremely weird. So as I was taking the escalator back up, I got off the escalator, turned around, and tried to take a photo of her as she rode up the escalator behind me. And she literally turned around 180 degrees and rode the escalator backwards, which gave me a sense that, okay, this is not just a coincidence. I don't have any training in, counter-espionage skills, but something about turning 100%, 100% backwards clued me in.
A regular James Bond.
It doesn't seem like she had a lot of training in counter-espionage skills either.
No. I mean, well that's, an issue that emerges in this. You know, was this person subtly trying to follow me to make me not notice? Or were they just being horribly clumsy in an attempt to make me notice that I was being followed? Now, considering the intellectual level of the average person who works for Chinese state media, I'm guessing it was the former. They were just quite bad at following me. But, you know, the latter is always possible. Anyway, once I noticed this person following me, basically anytime I stopped, they stopped and pretended they were doing something else.
And you forgot that they were following you at that point, naturally, right?
No. Eventually, you know, I just wanted to go sit down, kind of read a book, relax. But with, you know, this dummy following me, I didn't really feel terribly comfortable doing that. So I ended up just taking the MTR back to my hotel. And curiously, it seemed that nobody followed me because I did. You know, it's funny. I tried to just figure out like a few things I could do on my own at the moment to see if I was being followed, like, you know, pretending to get on an MTR train and then just kind of hopping off at the last moment right before, you know, the train departs, and then seeing, you know, if anybody else hopped off with me. Now, I unfortunately regularly do that kind of thing nowadays in Hong Kong. And unfortunately, there's a growing number of people who have to do that type of thing in Hong Kong on a daily basis. So those people suffer quite a bit more than I do. But I really had no idea who had been following me until I got back to Australia, you know, 10 days later or so, and realized that I was on the front cover of Wen Weibo, which is a widely distributed but not terribly popular Beijing-owned newspaper in Hong Kong. They get their circulation up by dropping, you know, 20 copies of their horrible paper in basically every apartment block in Hong Kong. And people then use those newspapers to, you know, collect their dog feces and things like that. So that's Wen Weibo. That's what they do. I think the fuss that I made about them following me certainly served to, how shall I say it, make them divert their attention from me. They haven't bothered me since. But I'm certainly not under the illusion that I travel to Hong Kong free from any surveillance. The paper is, of course, owned by the Beijing Liaison Office. So this was effectively, you know, Beijing spying on me in Hong Kong. And I don't think, I think everything that we see in Hong Kong today shows that Beijing doesn't really learn any lessons from its mistakes. So I'm sure that they, you know, continue to follow me from time to time, just probably in more subtle ways that I don't notice. Or perhaps they've realized that they do have better things to do than just follow a, you know, clumsy guy who meets a few people and then goes to either Five Guys or Shake Shack for dinner. You know,
wait, there's Shake Shack in Hong Kong?
Yeah. There's actually two Shake Shacks.
How did we not know about this, guys?
Oh, my God. We spent all our time going to McDonald's.
All right, we're going back to Hong Kong, guys.
For the Shake Shack.
Yeah. Because I mean, there's no Shake Shack.
There's no Shake Shack or Five Guys in Australia. One of the benefits of me doing research in Hong Kong is not only that I can discover interesting things, you know, write good articles. It's also that I can, you know, visit Shake Shack and Five Guys regularly. So, yeah.
And that's important. Well, you would just, when you were under surveillance, that was December 2018, but you had just gotten back recently from Hong Kong, right?
Yeah. I was there in June. I was also there in August. I'm traveling there quite regularly. Yeah.
So tell us what you're researching on related to Hong Kong.
I'm working on the emergence of tensions between the People's Republic of China and Hong Kong over the past, 22 years since Hong Kong's integration into China.
Well, are there any tensions now?
Yeah. So, as I always say, I'm a little busy right now. But I'm particularly focused on, the emergence of the Hong Kong nationalist movement or the Hong Kong independence movement as a sort of product of those tensions. So, right now is obviously a fascinating, busy time. I had the pleasure of being in Hong Kong on June 12th, the day that this current wave of protests, really kicked off.
So you got tear gassed?
Yes. I actually landed in Hong Kong early in the morning of June 12th. I went directly to Admiralty, where the Legislative Council is. And I was, quite surprised to see literally thousands of people there already. By 8 a.m., the main stretch of road in front of the Legislative Council, of course, I forget the street name, had been, occupied by protesters. I watched as that unfolded. I was quite excited to see, really, after years and years of pressure building up since 2014, with the central government and the local government both, becoming increasingly interventionist in Hong Kong politics and society, it was exciting to see people finally, coming out and really, making their voices heard, expressing that their deep dissatisfaction with not only this, horrible extradition legislation, but also just with the general direction in which Hong Kong was moving all of these years. So that morning was a moment of, hesitant optimism, right? To finally see this large turnout and this kind of burst of activism in response to this legislation. Now, the afternoon was a completely different story. By about 3 o'clock, the police began to essentially lose their minds, firing tear gas like it was just, I don't know what they were firing tear gas like it was.
Like it was just going out of fashion.
Roman candles.
Yeah, it was almost as if their tear gas was about to expire, and if they didn't use it that day, it was going to be
maybe
overdue.
That's what happened.
They're cleaning out their tear gas fridge,
I mean, we do know that there was some expired tear gas, so...
indeed. That was my attempt to sort of reference that, right? Because, there's been firing of a lot of expired tear gas.
Is expired tear gas better or worse than regular tear gas?
It's neither is great. I wouldn't recommend either as
somebody who is now a connoisseur.
Yeah. It's not like something I order on the side with dinner.
I mean, do you have a favorite vintage?
Yeah. But I've, of course, I'm not a scientist, but I've read that, you know, the reason tear gas has an expiration date is because the contents in it can degrade and become potentially poisonous with, you know, potential cyanide development. Of course, someone listening could say that I'm wrong. I'm not a tear gas scientist. I'm not even a scientist. I'm just, you know.
You're a guy with a certificate in Xi Jinping thought.
Yeah. And I've just choked on some tear gas, you know, the last 2 months. That afternoon, the police lost their minds. I first went to Hong Kong, 17 years ago. I remember, you know, thinking of the police as, like, how shall I say it? I mean, police that I could trust, people that I could talk to if I had a problem.
You sound so skeptical saying this now.
Yeah.
You were so young and naive.
Yeah. I mean, I was coming from China at the time, you know, and police, how shall I say it? I mean, I never felt like while I was in China, like, oh, you know, if I encounter a problem, I can go talk to this policeman and he'll be really cool and helpful. But that was indeed how I felt in Hong Kong. And so I was shocked to see the way the police acted. June 12th, I mean, indiscriminately firing tear gas, you know, indiscriminately firing rubber bullets, chasing people with batons, chasing me. And I had to jump over a barricade that protesters had constructed to get away from the police. And, you know, that was the most exercise I've ever had in the last decade. I mean, you guys have seen me. You don't want to see me running down the street, huffing and puffing in, 100 degree heat, especially with a, you know, policeman chasing me with a baton. It's not a pretty sight. Eventually, the police chased us into the various office buildings surrounding Admiralty, office buildings and malls. People got closed in Pacific Place. I got closed in, I think it was Lippo Plaza, which is an office building. And we were just, you know, police stood at the door and just blocked us from leaving, which was, I think, perhaps a fire hazard, but also completely insane because at this point it was 5 o'clock, 5:30. You know, everybody who works in Lippo Plaza was getting off work and they're coming down. There's a bunch of people in gas masks in the office building lobby and police blocking everybody from leaving. So, of course, you know, they're a bit shocked and confused. And eventually, you know, I gradually made my way out a back door toward Central, thinking that the protests had been cleared. When all of a sudden I noticed that the main thoroughfare in Central was, you know, still occupied. I think that was kind of a testament to you know, the strength of these protesters. You know, I got chased away. We all got cleared out. But there were still people there, you know, 8 p.m., 9 p.m., all the way until late into the night. And still, you know, more than 2 months later, more than 80 days later, longer than the movement of 2014, there's still, you know, people coming out in full force And obviously, this is no longer just about an extradition bill. I think it is, you know, fundamentally about a completely non-transparent, completely unaccountable Hong Kong government that doesn't serve the interests of the Hong Kong people. Its sole purpose is to serve the interests of Beijing. And that's not a government that the thoughtful and engaged people of Hong Kong deserve.
Have you seen a difference in the, because you were just there recently and you were there in June. Have you seen a difference in the protests in August versus June?
I think, yeah, well, when I was there in June, I think everybody was kind of still surprised, kind of, that this had become quite as big as it did, right? I was also there in April, and the first protest against, the extradition bill, you had maybe 5,000 people come out. You know, it was pathetic. So in June, when this all kicked off, I think there was kind of a widespread element of surprise, like, wow, this is, you know.
It's happening.
Actually, yeah, this is actually going down. Now, you know, what I would have expected in August, I would have thought there would be some kind of fatigue at some point. You know, I can't imagine going out and being chased by the police and choking on tear gas, you know, certainly every weekend, if not almost every weekday night, for 2 months. But I think people seemed, you know, just as energized, if not even more energized. One thing I did notice was how sincerely hated the police and the local government are right now. Of course, the local government as, you know, essentially a colonial extension of the central government. In the sort of surprise of June 12th, you know, there was the surprise that all those people came out. There was the surprise that, you know, the roads were occupied for the first time since 2014. But there was also surprise, of course, that the police behaved the way they did. By August, you know, there's no more naivete or surprise about the police behavior. There's almost a certain glee, right, in messing with the police, you know, pointing lasers at them. And the police have almost come to be seen as, how shall I say it, you know, just the main representatives of, you know, what's come to be seen as almost an occupying force. You know, those are big dramatic words. That's essentially how I felt people saw them. So as a result, I don't see any easy path out for these protests. People, I think, are even more determined and even more angry than they were in June, precisely because the longer that this conflict goes on, the more anger and animosity builds up due to the government and the police's mishandling of these protests.
When you say the people are upset with the police, you know what? We've seen, I think, three times since June, more than a million people coming out to protest. But a lot of these smaller protests, the ones that get tear gassed, are like, you know, several thousand or you know, something in that neighborhood, right? And so is the public anger at the police broad, like, you know, the quarter of the city that comes out to protest and those, you know, those big
movements, or is it more that it's sort of concentrated within the smaller number of more active younger protesters?
That is a good question. I mean, I think that the particular anger that I'm talking about could be, you know, sort of could be attributed to kind of the smaller group of, you know, protesters who are, you know, pointing lasers at police and things like that, or gathering outside police stations and yelling. At the same time, however, I do think that disappointment and concern about the police is considerably more widespread. Now, I, you know, talk to a fairly select group of people, of course, who are by no means representative of sort of, you know, the middle ground in Hong Kong politics. But I think that whether we're talking about, you know, media or, you know, sort of casual conversations on the streets, people are, I think, greatly disappointed and concerned about the way the Hong Kong police have responded to this series of protests, with really quite excessive and unnecessary force. So there's, I think, an important distinction, right, between being disappointed in the police and joining further, you know, peaceful protests versus, you know, people who are really angry at the police and engage in the type of behavior that we saw, you know, last Saturday with people chasing after police, kicking police, fighting back against police.
Occasional Molotov.
Yeah. But what I would say is that that kind of behavior was really, I think, unthinkable on June 12th, right? I watched as police approached and people ran away, you know? So now that we've reached a point where people are angry enough about the police where they just say, whatever, I'm not going to run away from the police. I'm going to, you know, stand here and fight with them. I think that's not a reflection of a problem with the protesters so much as it's a reflection of a problem with the way the police have handled this, and essentially cultivated, I would almost say, you know, a considerable percentage of a particular generation of people who essentially think of the police as, you know, as I said, you know, an occupying force trying to deny them basic rights and freedoms that have actually been guaranteed under the basic law, but that are now at substantial risk of being denied.
It's almost like the police are creating their own antagonists.
Yeah. And I mean, starting from June 12th, you know, I heard people saying, oh, you know, there's Chinese police from Guangdong who have come over, you know, to Hong Kong. And I'm, you know, I'm certainly not naive or overly optimistic. I think that that could be, you know, a possibility, right? But I think another possibility is just that people in Hong Kong didn't ever envision that their police could behave like this, right? And so there's this need to kind of externalize it, to think of, oh, well, these must be, you know, Chinese cops who have come over. In reality, if you look at, you know, the Hong Kong police force, you know, they've gone and received crowd control training in Xinjiang. So as with all matters It's increasingly difficult when we're talking about governmental matters to draw any type of distinction between, you know, the Chinese authorities and the Hong Kong authorities. You know, people still hope for and wish for that difference, even as it disappears increasingly rapidly.
So when you say Hong Kong police seem to have lost their minds, do you think it is a result of more influence from Beijing, whether it's crowd control in Xinjiang, which has very peaceful streets, by the way? And, or like, why did they lose their mind? That's something people have been asking.
Yeah, I mean, on the one hand, I can acknowledge their jobs are not easy. I mean, you know, if I had to stand outside doing crowd control this entire summer in Hong Kong, I'd probably be a little grumpy too. But the problem is that, you know, everybody's jobs are difficult. Everybody's jobs make people grumpy, right? You know, just because I'm having a difficult class where people, you know, aren't contributing to the discussion or didn't do the reading,
I can't just fire tear gas at your students.
Yeah. I can't just say like, oh, do the reading next time or I'm going to bring tear gas to class, you know. A similar logic, applies to the Hong Kong police. But the problem is that essentially they've been given, you know, essentially endorsement to really do whatever they want without any accountability. And as a friend who I met during my last visit to Hong Kong commented to me, he said, oh, you know, if I could do whatever I wanted without any accountability, you know, I'd be a horrible piece of as well, you know. That's really, you know, the reality that we're facing. You know, police are admittedly under great pressure, but they've also been given sort of a get out of jail free card, such that they no longer need to maintain seemingly any type of discipline. And they feel, you know, entitled to just, fire tear gas, chase people, hit people. An example that I would share from my recent visit to Hong Kong, this was at this point about 12 days ago, the weekend in which no tear gas was fired. I think it was the 11th week of protests.
It's sad that that's now the exception to the rule.
Yeah. You know, and this was, you know, a major, you know, topic in media coverage. Hey, no tear gas was fired this weekend. Okay. But a cop shot, you know, a beanbag round, less than 20 meters from me. And that was not at all a reasonable, you know, option at that moment. But the cop did that, you know, people were shocked for a moment. And then there was almost no reporting on it. Instead, it was, oh, the weekend without tear gas, right? So how shall I say it? Yeah, the Hong Kong police have... Yeah, they feel entitled to do whatever they want to do. There's a reason that they feel that way, because the Hong Kong government has said, you know, Carrie Lam has openly said that she's not going to endorse an independent commission looking into police brutality. So there's simply no accountability, and there is thus really no way out of these building tensions between the people and the police, which is also, you know, the police are representative, of course, of the Hong Kong government and, of course, the central government, of which both are really just an extension.
We were there the night July 1st when the protesters broke into LegCo. Mm-hmm. And it seemed like the government was waiting for this moment when the people of Hong Kong more broadly would turn against the protesters. Mm-hmm. But that doesn't seem to have happened. Would you say that's like, you know, you were there recently, like, does it seem like people still broadly support the protesters?
Yeah. I mean, again, you know, I'm talking to, a very specific group of people. But looking at, you know, even just the turnout last night, Hong Kong time, in Central, for a protest against essentially sexual violence enacted by the police against female protesters in strip searches and other quite disturbing developments, you had a really substantial turnout there. And I think what we're seeing is, sure, people may be to a degree tired out by all the protests. Sure, people may wish that things could just go back to normal. But I think that people are not placing the blame for things being abnormal on the protesters, but rather, you know, placing that blame squarely at the feet of the Hong Kong and central governments, and realizing that in their refusal to yield, their refusal to give, you know, even an inch, it seems, other than saying that the bill is dead but not officially withdrawn, of course, which is contradictory, there's, I think, real substantial and understandable disappointment at the government as really the primary driver of these protests, not so much protesters themselves. And I think that's important to recognize, and just as long as that remains the way people tend to view these protests, I think they'll enjoy widespread support.
It seems like the Hong Kong government's strategy is, if you want to change people's hearts, crack down even harder.
Yeah. And I mean, this is, you know, I don't want to compare what's happening in Hong Kong to what happened in Beijing in 1989. But I want to say that the way that they're responding is a not Tiananmen model, but post-Tiananmen model. Insofar as, you know, after the violence in Tiananmen Square, there was, and of course, you know, far beyond, you know, Musidi, Chengdu, etc., you know, there was an attempt to essentially use a combination of economic opportunism and political taboos, right, to get people to sign kind of a social contract wherein, so far as one stays away from politics, you know, everybody can make money and supposedly be happy, right? That's the post-Tiananmen model in China. And I feel like there has been an attempt to sort of enact that in Hong Kong in recent years, you know, trying to focus on quote-unquote livelihood issues while steering away from giving any ground on major political issues that are the source of people's main discontent. And the only problem, of course, with this model is that it can work when you have absolute control over media, absolute control over educational institutions, and essentially absolute control over, you know, almost all of society, as the CCP does in China. But when you're dealing with a complex society with an open media, open internet, you know, opinion leaders who are generally not afraid to share their real opinions, this kind of, you know, focus on let's just get busy with economics and stay away from political issues, it simply doesn't work, because people naturally have interest in and investment in political matters and, you know, want to be involved. I think the problem that emerges here is that Beijing really doesn't know how to deal with a complicated, you know, diverse society over which it doesn't exercise absolute control. We see, you know, as a result, the exercise of power, you know, very much unraveling. Really the only way that they know how to respond is crack down, plus a few economic incentives. I often make predictions that are often wrong, but I will say, you know, without a political solution to the current events in Hong Kong, there's really, you know, no path out.
Well, it seems like another part of the problem is also the Hong Kong police now are very incentivized to make sure there is no independent investigation into police brutality, because I don't think that would go very well for them.
Yeah. And, you know, clearly they have behaved in a completely undisciplined, non-professional manner. If they had, they wouldn't be opposed to an independent investigation, right? There doesn't seem to be a way forward there. We see kind of the emergence of, you know, almost a police state, right? Insofar as the police in Hong Kong can now act essentially without having to pay any price for their own misbehavior. That teaches the police the wrong lesson. And obviously it's not terribly popular with the general public.
Well, I think that's also dangerous for the Chinese Communist Party, because if they don't hold that kind of control over Hong Kong police and they start acting more independently, that could put the Communist Party in a politically awkward situation.
Yeah. And I mean, I've been, I think, quite shocked and disappointed with the degree to which, you know, Hong Kong police not only, you know, obey orders, but almost go beyond orders. There has been sort of growing anger at and dehumanization of protesters. When that's, you know, combined with, you know, complete unaccountability, you know, what really concerns me is the possibility that one of these days, you know, the police are going to get really out of control, even more than they already have, you know, and, you know, shoot somebody or something like that. I think when that happens, you know, things will spiral even further out of control than they already are. There's really, once that happens, you know, really no going back from that.
Do you think there's any chance this could spread to mainland China?
Well, I think that would be very interesting and exciting. There is, of course, you know, a massive propaganda effort to discredit the Hong Kong protests. I haven't been to China recently, so I don't know how widespread that is believed, but I'm sure that, you know, a considerable number of people believe it. For those who don't believe it, of course, the issue that emerges is even if they do take action, try to go out onto the streets, the central government is, you know, far less restrained in responding to protests in China than it is in Hong Kong. So how shall I say it? I mean, you know, while that would be interesting to see, I would be afraid that it would just result in, you know, more violence from the state, unless people found, you know, an effective way to push back against that violence, which is, you know, possible perhaps, but difficult to predict.
Well, in an attempt to try and end this on a slightly more lighthearted note, which was worse, studying Xi Jinping thought or being quarantined for SARS?
I would say, I wish I could have gotten them done all at once, you know, like be quarantined and while I was there, just study some Xi Jinping thought. But that would unfortunately, you know, require a quite an odd time machine. I would say that, you know, actually, I think both were important learning experiences. You know, I think I went to China in the early 2000s. I think, of course, very open-minded, but also to a degree very naive about the nature of the Chinese state, and a series of events in my life helped, I think, to help me to kind of see kind of the reality of the current Chinese government without any quote unquote, how shall I say it, colored glasses, right? To borrow, I guess, a common term.
The rose colored glasses, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. And I think being quarantined during SARS was just kind of a first step in thinking about these matters. I remember watching CCTV at the time. And, you know, quite a few people were quarantined at the time. I was quarantined simply for being foreign, which was quite amusing.
The worst disease of all.
Yeah. I watched, you know, CCTV news at the time, and there were all these reports about, hey, you know, when you think about it, being quarantined is fun. People bring you. You can just kick back, relax at home. People bring you food, you know. Now, the ironic thing was nobody brought me food. I don't know if it was because they didn't know what I ate. You know, they were like, oh, I don't know. What does he want? A hamburger? Oh, you know. or if the news reporting about bringing food was simply, you know, not true.
And they didn't have Five Guys or Shake Shack in Beijing at the time.
No, unfortunately not. So I had to resolve that, you know, on my own. One thing that I did get delivered every day was two guys who, they looked like they came out of that scene in the movie E.T., right? Where the people come in the full body, kind of suits. Whoa.
Like the hazmat suits?
Yeah. And they would roll up at my apartment. I'm sure my neighbors, who I think reported me to the authorities, would love this. They show up in hazmat suits and take my temperature. And, of course, I didn't have a temperature because I hadn't gone anywhere. And, Nanjing at the time didn't have SARS, right, everybody? Wink, wink. These people would show up every day at different times of the day. Take my temperature. Eventually the quarantine, was lifted. I do have to say, I learned a lot in those few days. I think my studies of Xi Jinping thought were kind of a continuation in that vein of being endlessly disappointed in the current state of politics in the People's Republic of China.
Xi Jinping thought is just a quarantine for your mind.
Yeah, indeed.
Well, I think we're out of time today, Kevin. Thank you so much for joining us. There's a bunch of things I wanted to ask you about the situation in Australia, particularly with the issues of mainland Chinese students and Hong Kong students kind of facing off there. We'll have to get you on another time, I think.
Hey, anytime.
Awesome. For now, if anybody listening wanted to learn more about you or what you do, where should they go? Do you have a Twitter handle or someplace you like to direct people?
Oh, yeah. I'm on Twitter at Kevin Carrico. That's KevinCarrico. Feel free to pick up a copy of my book, The Great Han.
Yeah, so I look forward to having you on another time.
Yeah, for sure. I look forward to it as well.
Cool. And thank you for listening. Once again, I'm Chris Chappell.
I'm Shelley Zhang.
And I'm Matt Gnaizda.
And be sure to check out Path of Cha for some delicious, delicious tea. Link is below. Use that link to order and you'll help support the show. The link verbally is www.pathofcha.com/?ref=China Unscripted. Buy some tea, support the show. Talk to you later.